I need to do a little bit of cleanup from yesterday. Because we're just wandering around in this casual fashion, didn't finish giving you a number of the illustrations that I had intended, and I don't want to, I'm not going to work over the illustrations with you, but many of you, I think, will be helped to have reinforced the evidence of what really amounts to scholarly foolishness on the part of Michael Martin in the way that he has conducted his argument against God's existence. Page 277, I believe, is one of the illustrations that I gave you of his dogmatism. Just let me check that real quickly. He says, although not all theories of faith have been examined here, the ones that were are representative enough to give us confidence that all such arguments will fail. Page 37 gives a particular illustration of the same state of mind and approach to things. Page 37. About three quarters of the way down, he is referring to a reductio of convicts argument or theory, and he says this is a reductio, since we have, now listen to this language, excellent reason to suppose that such occult explanations are not true. This is page 37 of the book. How could he have excellent reason to suppose that occult explanations are not true so early in the book? I mean, isn't he supposed to prove that occult explanations are impossible? Obviously, if God exists and if there are demons, occult explanations are, you know, one possibility. So if he already has excellent reason to suppose that's not a possibility, why didn't he just move this up closer to the beginning of the book and say, we have excellent reason to suppose God doesn't exist? Okay, I'm not going to belabor it. My point is that over and over again, he's taking for granted what he's supposed to be proving, and then he dishes it up with this little preface, excellent explanation, implausible that, absurd that, irrational this, and so forth. That's not argument. This is pontification. Another example, 197. Talk about pontifical prejudice in a scholar. Three quarters of the way down again. I'm picking up in the middle of the sentence. He says, what credence should we give to reports of miracles made in biblical times by less educated and less sophisticated people without systematic controls against fraud? Wave your hand and send it all away. It's kind of like, yeah. Oh yeah, well, they were stupid back then. Now, I realize he has the grace not to be that blunt, but that is what he's saying. He's saying basically, why give credence to what people who didn't know better believed? They weren't modern scientific people like us in this conference that I'm doing, I did last weekend and planning to do in San Diego. I refer to this mentality and really go off on it as a form of personal prejudice and arrogance. In the first place, if you look around today, you'll find plenty of gullible people and people who believe silly things about get-rich schemes and diet plans and pyramids and all kinds of things. Okay, so let's just not automatically assume we're so much smarter than that culture in general. And then secondly, let's not forget that they were skeptical in that day too, so skeptical that even New Testament writers address it and say, we're not making this up. That's my paraphrase. We didn't follow cunningly devised fables, Peter says. And so the idea that one culture is superior to the other in terms of skepticism or worse than the other in terms of gullibility, I don't think he's in a position to say. This is just overwhelming pride that leads a man to say, I don't have to consider that evidence. They were stupid back then. I want you to look at a few other pages where this comes up. 198 and 202. First of all, 198.
That was Mr. Tabish's argument a lot in trying to disprove, was attacking the gullibility and unsophisticated.
Yeah, I might elaborate real quickly for you. Those of you who have not heard the Tabish debate will be interested that, although I, again, resisted engaging this very much because I wanted to keep him over on my debate plan, but he wanted to know how I could hold to the inerrancy of the Bible when it was written by people in a day when they didn't have typewriters and computers and copying machines. I must admit, you know, you have to be careful. Your people are watching your reactions, but I felt like going, what is wrong with you? You know, and in fact, I finally did say to him, I said, well, you know, have you forgotten what the Christian hypothesis is? It's God, an omnipotent, sovereign God, who led these people to do this. He doesn't need copy machines and computers and so forth. But the whole idea is, yeah, they were just so ignorant, you know, and they're so backward. Primitive, I think he called them, superstitious, whatever. Okay. Page 198. First full paragraph. Further, alleged miracles may not be due to some trick or fraud, but to a misperception based on religious bias. People full of religious zeal may see what they want to see, not what is really there. We know from empirical studies that people's beliefs and prejudices influence what they see and report. That's true, but guess what? That's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Since people's prejudices affect what they see, their prejudices also affect what they don't see. In fact, that's the more interesting part of Gestalt psychology. Those are the studies he's referring to. It really is fascinating. We can't run out of time to get into it. But you can put something up on a screen in a context where people are expecting, whether there's motion or succession, and you can put something up on a screen that does not fit what the motion is or the succession expected. And when you ask people, did you see the Ace of Spades, they'll say no. The significance of that would, maybe we should do a whole seminar just on, you know, empirical studies of perception and so forth. But the point is, if people cannot see what they don't expect to see, and that's what Gestalt psychology shows, as much as seeing things that aren't there, it's actually more the not seeing the things that are there because you didn't expect them, then it turns out this is not the sort of thing he should be calling up in his own defense. Page 202. Why did I put that down? Oh, because when he talks about the miracles at Lourdes in the first paragraph underneath the subheading, he says, if these alleged miracles are suspect, we would have good ground for maintaining that other claims of miracles. Listen how he says this. In more distant times when superstition prevailed and objective documentation was either non-existent or at least much less in evidence, should not be taken seriously. Now, there's all sorts of problems with that sentence, not the least of which is the possibility of hasty or sweeping generalization. You all know informal fallacies. You know what a hasty generalization is? Is taking a few cases and then making a general principle out of them when the possibility exists the few cases you looked at were exceptional. Sweeping generalization is kind of the other side of the coin. It's like taking a general principle and trying to apply it to everything and not recognizing there are some unique cases. Milk is good for everybody. That's true, as a generalization. Give milk to a child that's allergic to milk and you can kill him. Okay? So there are generalizations, but if you apply them in a sweeping way and don't take account of exceptions. So the point here is he hasn't even cautioned himself against sweeping or hasty generalization when he talks this way. I've looked at a few cases, and surely the ones I would look at would be the best. Well, as a matter of fact, I know that maybe not everybody would agree with this, but my own theological conviction is that the miracles at Lourdes can either be discounted in advance because of what the Bible does teach us about miracles, or a variant of this, you'd have to say they are certainly not theistic miracles. They're being worked by the deceiver. But there are reasons to wonder whether in a Christian nation that happens too. Anyway, he can't just automatically assume that I'm going to go look at, you know, these ones at Lourdes and then I can get rid of all the rest. And especially can he not, and this is why we turn to it, can he just write off New Testament or Old Testament miracles because of the superstition of that age?
Well, he has to prove the superstition. Wouldn't he have to do that?
Yes, the next step would be, now he probably would say, oh, we all know that. But you have every right to say, well, I'd like to know that they were more superstitious than we are. His argument, I can almost imagine, would go like this. Well, we certainly know that they didn't have as much scientific knowledge as we do today. I mean, they didn't know how to put a man on the moon.
But that
wouldn't prove his point.
Yeah, it doesn't follow that it makes them superstitious.
No, because it's one thing to say we have more detailed knowledge, and it's another thing to say they were not interested in such detailed knowledge. Okay? In other words, to say that a person or a group is superstitious, I'm not doing this exactly as if I'd thought it through and written an article on it, but off the cuff, it's similar to saying they're not interested in pursuing, you know, scientific methodology at all. That they'll just take silly, non-scientific answers for things. Well, you don't prove that they didn't have a desire to know more about the world by saying we know more than they did. You say, well, yeah, I mean, so they didn't have the time and the instruments and developments and so forth. But to say that they were superstitious is to say, and they didn't care about that. But we do know that at least many people cared about it because they ridiculed the apostles for proclaiming the resurrection. You know, they said, we're too scientific to believe that kind of stuff. So, yeah, he would have to do more than just assert that they were superstitious. Right. Good point. Okay, I'd like real quickly to look at page 504, note 44. Page 504. I might just comment, since I have this in my margin, in the note preceding, at the top of the page, he says, Coldwell ignores the independent evidence we have from contemporary faith healers, indicating the difficulty of being skeptical when one is deeply involved in a religious movement. And don't you just shake your head and wonder that when he wrote this sentence, he didn't stop to say, I wonder if anybody would say that about me. You know, just change the terms around and say, it's very difficult, you know, to be skeptical of your atheism when you're deeply involved in the movement. Who's deeply involved? Here's a man who said that he ran away and wouldn't even go to chapel in the Marines. He didn't want to go to church so badly. Loves his grandfather. I mean, I'd say he's deeply involved. I'd say the fact that he goes around, you know, giving lectures, debating, writing books, and so forth, he's deeply involved. And so, if what he's saying is true, it's like this Gestalt observation a minute ago. But that's a two-edged argument. So I wouldn't pick it up until you're sure you can show you are safe from it, and now the others are going to get cut. I think this cuts both ways. But now, the reason I had you turn to this page is note 44. I guess I should read the whole thing. He says, Karl Barth, a German theologian of the Enlightenment, suggested that Jesus walked on floating pieces of timber. Forgetting the rest of the footnote, I would think a scholar would be embarrassed to reference that kind of theory. But, again, embarrassment's a subject of your worldview, I guess, what you think is plausible. I find that the kind of thing only stupid children might say. Well, I don't mean stupid in the nasty way, but uneducated and dull, intellectually dull children might think you could walk on floating pieces of timber like that. Now, you can walk on logs, right? But Of course, the problem with that thesis is that very few people would fail to see the logs you were walking on. So you'd think you could dismiss it, right? Well, he goes on. He says, he speaks of these two, the Kellers. The Kellers raise two objections to Bart's explanation. They argue that according to Scripture, the boat was not near the shore, and that in any case, Jesus' disciples would have noticed the timber. Yep. However, it's uncertain whether Scripture is correct about the location of the boat. Why is it uncertain?
There's nothing certain.
Because anything that proves what I don't want it to prove has got to be uncertain. Isn't that amazing circular reason? And again, he doesn't even protect himself. He doesn't even give some kind of lengthy explanation of why it's uncertain. He goes, well, it's just uncertain. However, it's uncertain whether Scripture is correct. In any case, if we substitute rocks for timber, hopefully he doesn't mean floating rocks, the location of the boat, according to Scripture, can be accepted. Rocks below the surface of the water may extend for many furlongs out to sea. The Kellers mention Bart's not implausible explanation of the failure of the disciples to notice. Now listen to this, quote, they were held prisoner by the prejudices of their own miracle-believing age. Now when I see somebody preferring an explanation that requires the disciples not to see the rocks that Jesus is standing upon, and then he says, and the reason they didn't see it is because they were held captive or prisoner by the prejudices of their age, I put in my margin, who's displaying prejudice here? Who's being held captive? I mean, that's a pretty way out explanation. But then again, I realize, given his worldview, he thinks that's more plausible than that Jesus walked on water. I find it nearly inconceivable, apart from prejudice, that a person would think that Jesus was walking on water and his disciples, who have got to be in the same location, don't see the rocks.
No. In that case, then Peter must have walked on rocks for a little while and then fallen off.
Yeah, and he didn't realize that's what he was doing either. Well, I mean, if he's held captive by a miracle working of the prisoner of these silly ideas, then he has this thing happen to him and he gets back and he goes, I walked on water. They say, no, you ninny, you were on top of the rocks. You didn't see him. No, I'm held captive by a miracle working prejudice. Come on.
His fallback, if you take the argument he used in the other book, was that wouldn't be, well, that was probably written way after all the people involved died anyway, it probably never even happened.
Yeah,
you
could say these stories arose after it was possible to check them, but that doesn't deal with the problem, because the problem has an internal implausibility, and that is that you would have somebody write a story as though the disciples didn't see the rocks, but Jesus knew about them. So the problem just resurfaces in another form. Okay, we've got to move on, because I'm really just cleaning up from yesterday, and I'm going to... Go ahead.
One thing I noticed, though, if you go to page 260, and this is just one example,
okay,
but he actually even uses what I would call a form of politically correctness to prove his points. If you read the paragraph 60, we shouldn't, but there are many people who question G and give plausible. It's just the fact that there's many people, doesn't even say who these people are, mm-hmm, or what they're questioning, or just the fact. So it, obviously, if more people don't believe God exists than do, then it's plausible then.
Yeah, it's the nose count argument. But it's worse than that, because since he's giving a definite description, what he really means is there are many people that I count as significant. Okay, it's like scholarship says, or sophisticated, well, in other words, those that I consider, you know, worthy of that designation. So the whole thing is one, all I'm getting at over again is it's just one long circular argument. But if you make the circle big enough, as John Frame, you know, uses the illustration, as long as you make it big enough, then you can fool yourself that it's not circular. But it is. And I'm going to give you what I think is the example of examples from what he does here as being circular and not being critical of his own working assumptions. He does it on so many pages, and we can't look at them all. But you may want to listen if you're taking notes. I have him down as making this crucial move to not only support his hypothesis, but to defend it So, I mean, it is major evidence for him in terms of presentation of his point of view. On pages 47, 48, 49, 52, 58, 59, and then 486 and 488. I'm not sure that I have them all, but by giving that many, hopefully you won't force me to read it all to you. My point is, this is not just a passing, oops, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have said that. He comes back to it over and over and over again. I wonder if you know what it is. Let's look at pages 47 and 48. Seems like all my illustrations are down at the three quarters point on the page. That's where this one is too. And here he's speaking of the verifiability theory. And why should we hold to the verifiability theory? I was knocked off my chair when I read this the first time, because I didn't know in advance that this is the sort of thing he would do. I mean, now I know. It's not so surprising when I run into it. I was shocked. Thus, the verifiability theory matches our what? Our intuitions in clear cases of what is factually meaningful and what is not. Page 48. First full paragraph or second paragraph on the page. And this will be the third sentence. As we have seen, the verifiability theory matches our intuitions with respect to E. Thus, the theory can be understood as providing a clear criterion. Turn to 486 and 488. 486. He says about a particular move in the argument. This is footnote 15 at the bottom. However, this would conflict with religious believers' own intuitions on the matter. Further, such an interpretation would provide no explanation of our pre-theoretical judgments. Page 488. Another footnote. And this one is even stronger at the very top of the page, but the first full paragraph. He says, I disagree. I have already given a rationale for one version of the evidence principle. And what's your rationale? I mean, he's very self-conscious. My rationale about it is that it provides a criterion that matches our intuitions in clear cases and provides a criterion in more controversial cases.
We've already seen that.
Yeah, well, I started my list and then went to the end of the list and so forth, but over and over again he does this.
So it's interesting ways that as we've already seen and never saw, you just stated.
Yeah, as we've already stated, yeah, is what you should say. Let's put all this together. There's no justification for believing in God.
All this abbreviated as belief.
No justification for belief. And how does he know there's no justification? Because many justifications fail.
Attempts at justification fail.
Well, you've seen the problem. You can't move from many to no. I mean, that's a logical fallacy. But this professor of philosophy grants to himself the right to overlook the very thing we teach our students not to do. He moves from many to all, or from, you know, some to none, and so forth. And then, of the many justifications that fail, according to him, he means that they fail in terms of our present knowledge.
right? I'm just rehearsing what we've already gone over yesterday, the attenuation of the thesis that he's pursuing. It's in terms of our present knowledge, right? And it's not a conclusive failure, even in terms of our present knowledge. And these non-conclusive, temporally qualified arguments showing the failure of many of the arguments, it turns out, are themselves based on appeals to things like what is plausible. Without argument, it's a freestanding matter. And what is plausible, this is just an example, there are many other terms like that, and what is plausible and so forth is judged without a general and non-controversial theory of knowledge. So he has no general theory in terms of which he speaks of plausibility or implausibility. So we've attenuated it down to that point. But now, after all of that, what we are going to need to do, and this is what I want to get into today, if I finally get out of my introductory remarks, what we need to do is look at these arguments that are showing so little when all is said and done anyway. And now what I'm pointing out is, we haven't looked at the whole argument, is that his argument about verifiability comes down to a claim about what? Intuitions. All right, again, if you make the circle big enough, maybe you'll hide from yourself that it's circular. But if you follow this down, we run off the board here, I realize, but he follows down, he's saying, here's my claim. Your theistic belief is not justified. And you say, okay, well, cut through all the other stuff and just get me to the bottom line. Why not? Because it doesn't match my intuitions. Y'all follow that?
But he makes a distinction between the believer's intuition the our intuition.
In that footnote, what he's trying to do is he's trying to speak for us to show how a particular move in the argument won't work.
Okay.
Isn't that generous of him?
Yeah.
I feel like writing saying, I'll speak for my own intuitions, thank you. And the rest of my brothers and sisters will too. But he does that from time to time. He'll tell us, you know, what would be, we're going to get into this later, I think. He talks about what would be an adequate definition of omnipotence or omniscience. And, of course, I'm a Presbyterian. I'm prejudiced on this. I'm saying, why didn't you just go to the Westminster Confession and work with that? Okay? Now, that would impress me. You know, after all, these superstitious Puritans, what did they know about modern logic and so forth? But it turns out I brought my confession with me. When we get to that portion, I'm going to read what they said and say, guess what? Their definitions don't fall prey to what you're, you know, dealing with. Why, how do you miss that? You know, not everyone's a Presbyterian, but us Presbyterians think that's, you know, you can't avoid that as a major contribution to the history of theology. Well, he does that. He speaks for us. I'm getting off the track. His argument, if it's going to come down, not all of his arguments end up at the intuition level, I realize, and I'm not trying to portray it that way, but if his arguments do this sort of thing, you need to compress it from beginning to end and say, it's not justified to believe in God because it's contrary to our intuitions. And once you look at it that way, you say, well, I'm not real impressed. And why should you not be impressed? Well, because you can write the argument the other way, can't you? You can say, in fact, many people have said, the reason why we should believe in God is because that matches our intuitions. Okay. A few other cases where he is not critical of his own working assumptions. In fact, sometimes doesn't even seem to be aware of his own bias. Page 198. We're picking up on an illustration we've already looked at, but I want to go down one paragraph. This would be now the second full paragraph.
He says, in addition, religious attitudes often foster uncritical belief and acceptance. Indeed, in a religious context, uncritical belief is often thought to be a value, doubt and skepticism a vice. Thus, a belief arising in a religious context and held at first with only modest conviction may tend to reinforce itself and develop into an unshakable conviction. Well, I put in quotes, tend to reinforce itself. I would really like to have a materialistic explanation of how beliefs reinforce themselves. He must mean by that that the social community reinforces it or something like that. But whatever he means by it, that's a picky point. How is it that he writes this again and he doesn't seem to be aware that the very same thing could be said of him? In your circles, being critical and almost cynical and not believing anything is a value. And once somebody moderately begins with that attitude, it tends to reinforce itself. If you've known people at, you know, a secular college and so forth, they may have come from, a mildly Christian home, and, you know, at first they had some questions and doubts about the Bible, but then they got to a place where they said, you know, I think I've got some pretty good arguments against this, you know? How could God make a stone so heavy that he can't lift? I mean, I've actually known people who, you know, they really think I'm getting profound when I get to this level, you know? But once you reach the point where you're taken by that kind of thing, is it not true that those things tend to reinforce themselves? If you hang out in atheist circles and go to their club meetings and so forth, and you feel better about yourself because you're getting more critical and, hey, I can, you know, I can show how stupid these Christians are and so forth. I mean, that does tend to become a snowball too, right? And I would never show up at a secular university and use that, which I think everyone sees and knows happens, as an argument against atheism. But he turns it around and thinks that that's an argument against theism. And all I'm getting at here is that he's not even aware of his own biases. This doesn't give us a lot of confidence. Not only have I shown that he's not, in terms of some scholarly areas, competent or accurate in what he's saying, not only is he willing to dispute out all these things about rationality, plausibility, and so forth without a general theory and telling us that it would be controversial if he tried to put a general theory there, he doesn't even stop to look at his own. You know, it's like you don't have to be embarrassed by your presuppositions necessarily, but you ought to at least acknowledge them, be aware that you're operating under them. And then he has unquestioned assumptions over and over and over again in the book. Page 26. I just have to give up showing you all the illustrations that I wanted because I want to move on. Page 26. He tells us that it would be premature to offer a larger or more general theory in epistemology because we mentioned this yesterday. Given the controversial state of general epistemological theories, it is far better to develop middle-level principles and so forth. If you go down a few lines, you'll hear him say, I provide no general account of inductive arguments. I appeal to common, rational practices, regardless of how their details are construed by inductive logicians. Now, he could have helped himself, because let me show you under the microscope what might have helped him. He could have said, I appeal to common practices regardless of how their details are construed. Did you notice what he did? He assumed that the practices he's appealing to are what? Rational ones. But you see, without that general theory, he doesn't know whether they're rational or not. And this may seem like a very subtle point. I happen to think that those practices, if you look overall, are rational. So I don't have so much a problem with that. But I have a great problem with the fact that he just takes it for granted. He has his own working assumptions of which he is not willing to be critical.
He's basing his epistemology on, in faith, on someone else's work.
So to speak. That's what it amounts to. He wouldn't like it being put that way, but I do think it amounts to that. If he interprets the word faith as just some kind of a leap, he'd say, no, I'm not just leaping. We've watched the success of these people. And so you want to go a little bit further. A more sophisticated way of doing it is to say, well, in other words, you're assuming that after all the study is finished that this will turn out to be rational. That's your confidence that it will turn out that way. But at this point, the confidence doesn't have a foundation, not a fully worked out one. Go ahead, Ben.
In fairness to him, he could have good reasons for accepting their work, and he's just not giving them here, right?
No, he says it would be controversial to give them.
Oh. What does he mean further on in that
But
sentence?
He assumes that the details can be worked out.
Where he says, since this book's basic quarrel is with one version of foundationalism, I can with complete consistency accept other versions of foundationalism.
What he means is, in terms of the thesis that I'm offering here, it would not be inconsistent to accept certain versions. That's just an internal logical observation.
Okay.
There's no real claim about what can be proven or not proven. He's just saying, I'm not going to argue against all versions of foundationalism.
Are you saying that he assumes the rationality of a statement?
No, he assumes the rationality of those procedures, which have not been given a rational theory in terms of which they work.
So he needs an epistemology first to make that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
He sounds a little like more like he's kind of getting a common sense view of rationality.
Well, to be honest with you, common sense is not what many people commonly think it is. And the common sense view of epistemology is not really what he's resting on here. He would not say that there is a sense common to everyone whereby we can connect events. You know, it's almost like appealing to a common psychological disposition, common sense philosophy. And he would say, oh, I'm not doing that.
Wouldn't that be a branch of foundationalism, the common sense version?
Oh, it is, yes. One of many. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just jumping in here arbitrarily. I have these page numbers written down. Let's try 252 and 3. On page 253, a third of the way down the page, he's responding to Kierkegaard, and he says, but there may well be other religious beliefs that are even more absurd and improbable than Christianity. Okay. And how would he assess the degree of absurdity? I mean, I know how to make sense out of that in terms of my own views of what's rational and absurd. But he has to have, again, a general idea of what makes something rational and what makes something absurd to say there are degrees of absurdity. So he makes that remark, but you notice he doesn't give anything to back it up or even promise that a theory could be developed. And I don't think it's... Now, I realize that if he were sitting in the room, he might say, well, I already said it once. You know, and you know, you bagged on me about it then, but I've already said it. I don't think that he fails to repeat it here because he's trying to gain elegance in his writing and doesn't want to repeat himself. In fact, if I were criticizing this book in terms of writing style, that's one thing I'd hop on immediately. He repeats himself so often that I sit there reading a sentence expecting this to be something new, and then I stop and say, he's just telling me all over again what he said, you know, and just gets in the way of reading. So I know that it's not his tendency. Here's my inductive argument. It's not his tendency to seek elegance and not to repeat unnecessarily. So why is it that he talks about degrees of absurdity but doesn't tell us, well, of course, we have to work out a theory? My suggestion is he doesn't mention that is because he thinks he knows what is absurd. He doesn't even stop to be critical of his own assumptions. He just thinks he can throw that out there and everybody in the audience is going to agree with him. There are degrees of absurdity whereby Christianity is not as absurd as other things. Yeah.
Doesn't that also, that statement also kind of show that
he forgets that his...
That he what?
That that he's categorized in that... like his religious belief is categorized in that same...
Well, he does... He assumes a superior position
right.
in this. But you have to remember, he's talking about a theory that says that absurdity is good. And so, I mean, there are places where you can make that point. Here is not the best one, because what he's really getting at, he says, well, I'm not as good as these absurd people, given their views, because they think being absurd is very religious. All I'm saying is he makes passing reference to degrees of absurdity, but he just takes it for granted that he can talk about that meaningfully and that other people will know what he's talking about and agree with him. Page 278. While Wittgensteinian fideism appeals to ordinary religious practice and language to justify belief in God, Plantinga appeals to theoretical consideration from epistemology. Nevertheless, Plantinga's Reformed Foundationalism should be rejected, since his arguments against classical foundationalism are weak. The logic of his position leads to a radical and absurd relativism, and foundationalism in general has serious problems. Boy, that's making quick, issue of it, right? Plantinga's view leads to radical and absurd relativism, and in general, foundationalism has serious problems. Boom. That's it. Well, he'll do this over and over again. I'm going to give you only one other kind of illustration, then I promise we're moving on. Page 37. Oh yeah, the reason why I noted this is that this statement he made earlier about occult explanations, I told you when I referred to that, that I might have some problems with occult explanations. It all depends upon, your theological outlook, whether demonic activity is of such and such. And about miracles, I made that mention as well, that, your view of miracles at Lourdes has a lot to do with your theology. But I want to step back and generalize this. In terms of explaining things by, let's say, demons or, invisible Martians and other sorts of occult explanations, it is true that many people, in order to explain what they mean by scientific rationality, will say, they will take what we call paradigm examples or exemplars of what is good science and what is not good science. Okay, so you might say, as an exemplar of what is not rational or not good science, occult explanations. So if you treat what he's saying as, I'm just laying out for you my exemplars, that might be helpful, except that he doesn't seem to be aware that he's treating it as an exemplar. Because if he doesn't treat it as such, then anybody who believes in demons, all our astrologers and so forth, can all line up, gang up on him and say, what right have you to just rule out of existence what we're talking about? So if he's talking to me as a Christian, and I don't like those occult explanations either, he could say, if you'll take this as an exemplar or a paradigm, that's not the sort of thing either one of us want to be reduced to, right? I could say yes. But he doesn't amounts to an occult view of what causes things to happen. You follow me? If he had been good enough to identify this is what I take as one of the standard defining illustrations of how not to do science, I could have said, that's great. Because now I have something. Now you've given me a pousteau. Now I have something. We're going back So to the degree I can show that your view of the world is like a cult views, then you will have given me what I need to show you must give up your view of the world. Okay, so he has paradigm examples that he doesn't recognize as paradigm examples. He's unaware of his own biases, his unquestioned assumptions. And in terms of what most of us would have thought are exemplars or paradigm examples of rational thinking, scientific thinking, what may shock you is it turns out that Michael Martin is quite willing to give up our exemplars, our paradigms of rationality, if that's what's necessary to avoid the theistic conclusion. Let me state that again, because I really want you to get this in your notes, understand it. We've seen that he does use paradigm examples. I mean, he'll throw out the occult, not because he wants to beg the question, but he just wants us all to agree that's not what we call science. That's occult. Okay, fine. So he does use paradigms of rationality. And though I've not got a list of all those paradigms, I do know, I mean, I would bet the farm that I know that he would include in his paradigms of rationality a couple of things. If you're not looking at what I'm going to quote, he'd just take for granted, of course, an exemplar of rational thinking is abiding by first-order predicate logic. I mean, this is so basic that when you get into graduate school and so forth, if you have to teach one of these, you know, low-level courses in logic, it's almost like an insult to you. You know, you take these freshmen and sophomores, I mean, everybody knows first-order predicate logic, big deal, you know. Let's get on to the fun stuff. Let's get on to doxastic or modal or, you know, quantified logic or something, but all this other stuff is not all that big a deal. It would be what I think anybody assumes is an exemplar of rationality. Moreover, we are taught that Western rationality, the Western approach to science, is predicated on the view that things that happen in the physical world have antecedent conditions that explain what has happened. Explanation is to be by means of causality, reference to research into physical conditions and antecedent conditions. To put it very simply, we hold that explanation is by causal analysis. That's to be scientific. Am I saying anything controversial? Again, I don't think anybody would bat an eyelash if they didn't realize what's coming. So he has his exemplars. I'm assuming that first-order predicate logic and causal analysis is an exemplar of rationality. So now listen to these two quotes. First, page 52. In what is now a fairly standard refutation of the verifiability criterion, we have reference to a complex or a compound proposition. Okay? And we're going to get into how this all works in a little while, but my point is we have this compound proposition. And because it's compounded, it's possible to show that you can either directly or indirectly verify it, no matter what you put in the place of certain things. So that's considered a very strong refutation because it makes the verifiability criterion consistent with everything, in which case it's not a criterion. It doesn't work. Okay, and it's not just Christians who say that. When I went to graduate school, I felt right at home because the first week I was in my epistemology course, we were reading this kind of stuff, and they were just taking for granted. Everyone knows that A.J. Ayer and these guys, this is just not credible, even in secular circles. You will notice, by the way, I'm going to get off the subject for a minute, you'll notice that even our author, Michael Martin, admits that in pursuing this critique of religious language, he's in the minority today, philosophically. And he says, Kai Nielsen is the one guy who's holding on, you know, and he thinks he's doing a good job, and that's fine. But the point is, he knows that he's not in the mainstream of modern epistemology and language theory when he says these things. This is kind of like old stuff that these guys won't give up. and I'm going to show you in a few minutes, I hope, why they should. I mean, they should be embarrassed by that. But nevertheless, he gives a standard criticism of the verifiability criterion, and then he says, Wesley Salmon has given a way to avoid that, what amounts to reductio. Okay, now I've just been setting up the context. If you look in the middle of the page, 52, consequently, on this view, it would be impossible to have compound sentences with components that are neither true nor false. And this next one is just the killer. But Salmon maintains, and of course, Salmon's speaking for Michael Martin here because he's appealing to him to defend his, you know, his theory. But Salmon maintains the propositional calculus view of this matter lacks intuitive support. That's outrageous. What he's saying is, in order to defend my criticism of theism, I'm just going to put the whole picture together. I have a criticism of theism that is not factually meaningful. Now, people have refuted that criticism or appeared to. However, we can avoid that criticism if we do what? Depart from propositional calculus on the basis of intuition. This is much stronger than what I put up on the board here, that he appeals to intuition to explain, you know, this term or that or whatever. He's now saying intuition gives him the right to depart from propositional calculus and logic. If he were dealing with really abstruse areas of logic, modal logic can be really tough stuff sometimes, you might give him some leeway. You might say, well, maybe we haven't schematized things properly. You do occasionally appeal to intuitions to test whether you've got, you know, your logical sequences proper and your implication rules are the ones you want to use and so forth. But I don't think anyone in his right mind thinks that first-order predicate logic you are going to depart from on the basis of intuition. Particularly when the intuition that you're, particularly when intuition is being used to depart from what amounts to the definition of the word and in first-order predicate logic. The word and simply means that if you have S and T, the whole proposition, which is the compound, S and T, is true only when S is true and T is true. The only assignment of truth values that will allow for the compound to be true is true, true. If you have true, true, then the whole thing is true. Okay? False, true, or true, false won't make the compound true, and of course, false, false won't make the compound true. And this is one of the easiest things to explain to students in terms of truth table definitions of terms in logic. That's what he's departing from to defend himself. I find that just incredible. And he's good not to wave a red flag, you know. You notice he doesn't go on for paragraphs explaining this away and so forth. He just says, well, but on the basis of intuition, you wouldn't want to say that meaningfulness can be tested on the basis of the first-order predicate logic understanding of the word and. Okay, well, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. I just want the audience to know, when it comes to defending atheism, he's willing to depart from the exemplars of rationality in order to achieve his purpose. And then another example, page 199. And this is 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down from the very top. He says, advocates of the miracle hypothesis then must show that the existence of miracles is more probable than the existence of uncaused events. Oh, really? Ordinarily, when you're writing a book and dealing with arguments back and forth, you screen out all the material that's irrelevant. Okay? We have no discussion of sewage disposal systems in this book. Why? Well, obviously, because that's not what he's talking about, right? And nor does he take up, you know, strange theories like some of these guys you see on TV, you know, religious people. He says, well, that's not sophisticated enough. And that's fine. We wouldn't want to have to go through all the sewage disposal system information and every crank religious person. You know, we want him, in a sense, to do some screening for us. But that's interesting, because what he will not screen out is the theory that events are not caused. He doesn't happen to think that. But the point is, he thinks that's more credible than that God causes events. And all, again, I'm not trying to refute him. I'm just trying to let the audience know what you have here is a man who is willing to depart from an exemplar of rationality. He'd say, I would rather say things are uncaused than to say that God causes them. That's pretty desperate. Pretty desperate when you have a person saying, I will resort to anti-scientific and I will resort to violation of elementary universal laws of logic if that's what it takes to defend my theory. And all I want to ask now is, what if we were to have done that? Say, if I were to show up at his university and I'm lecturing in his class, and said, I've asked Dr. Bonson to come in and explain his epistemology and why he thinks it's rational to believe in God or the Bible, whatever it is. And if I would have stood up and I would have said, you know, most everything that I believe as a Christian, I think, is fairly easy to defend, and there's good reason for it. However, my faith in God is so strong that in those areas where I can't give you a good argument, I am willing to depart from the idea that events are caused, and I am willing to depart from first-order predicate logic in order to maintain my conclusion that God exists. You know, he'd probably say, Dr. Bonson, don't bother to finish the lecture. Because if you're willing to do that, why don't you just jump in at that point and say, I know God exists, you know, and I don't have any scientific or logical reason that I need. My point is, if we did this, we'd get hammered. In fact, we have been hammered. Over and over again, religious philosophers and anti-religious philosophers, they make fun of fundamentalists and so forth, and Bible thumpers and so forth. And they say it's because we're not rational. You know, we're closer to that occult kind of stuff, right? Well, what I've done here in the last few minutes, I'm just trying to show you the nature of the man you're talking to. This man is willing, he even admits, the slip is showing here, he admits that uncaused events are preferable to God, and violations of first-order predicate logic are better than having to say that my criticism of God is going to fall apart. I guess it all depends on what your, you know, your basic commitments are. His heart commitment, obviously, is a hatred of God, and that's why he's willing to give up what even he would otherwise call an exemplar of rationality.
What if I got up and said, one of the definitions I have of a miracle is an uncaused event?
Well, he would say that you're just playing with the term miracle. In fact, what I quoted you, in a sense, that's what he's doing. He's saying, well, even if we grant these sorts of things, you'd have to show that it's not uncaused. What you call a miracle, I will just call an uncaused event. And then if you reply, okay, well, then I'll just agree to use the word miracle for uncaused event, he'd say, fine, but then you don't have any proof of theism. Because if it's uncaused, then you don't show that it's related to God in any way. So that really wouldn't be a good move.
The point I'm trying to make is, isn't an uncaused event as hard to explain as a miracle at least?
No, actually miracles are only hard to explain in, how can I put it, the mechanical sense.
But so is an uncaused event.
No, an uncaused event is hard to explain conceptually too. So it's not just lack of information about how you have somebody put his foot on the water and he doesn't sink in. That's a lack of, if you will, empirical understanding or explanation. But uncaused event, I mean, that's a broad metaphysical notion that many people think is conceptually problematic. And I started a few minutes ago by saying, without the teacher explicitly putting this to you, when you were taught what scientific mentality is, you were basically being told, we're going to get beyond the primitive superstition about uncaused events, the idea that things just happen, you know, willy-nilly. No, there's a reason why things happen, and then you pursue that into causal analysis and empirical research and so forth.
But isn't God the ultimate uncaused event?
No. The ultimate uncaused...
Not in terms event. Of event, but the uncaused cause.
Yeah, and now if you want to take God in that way, I mean, there may be reasons to be cautious about it, but if you want to say God is an uncaused event, then what we have been taught in Western, you know, education recently is that we don't want to make every event a god. What we're saying, that's just part of the superstition, to make everything that happens, you know, just the example of gods. Hylozoism, the Greek, ancient Greek view, explained motion as everything's full of gods. And it's thought to be a step in the direction of science and away from hylozoism when you don't bring in uncaused causes. There's got to be some law of nature in terms of which you explain things. So does that help?
Yeah, but from the Christian biblical worldview.
To be very honest with you, I avoid using the language of uncaused cause, not only because it's philosophically perplexing, but I think it doesn't do justice to the personality of God. I think it's legitimate, and we will later, I keep saying that, but I'm running behind still, we will later talk about the freedom of God. And by freedom, if you mean it's not caused by external factors, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you mean God does, the events that we call God, are not caused, you really mean they are self-caused events, don't you? You don't want to put them outside of any pattern of rationality or explanation.
Right.
Because that's what an uncaused event would be. It's better to say God does what he wishes to do, in which case he is the explanation.
Right.
Okay. Okay, I'm done with my introductory comments, finally, to review for you. And I want you to keep looking for these things, but I maintain that Michael Martin is not always accurate in his scholarship, that he shows bias, sometimes blatantly shows bias, that he's not critical of his own assumptions, and that he's willing to go to extremes to protect his presupposed atheism. I maintain that he begs the question in terms of general conceptions about plausibility, rationality, and so forth, that he has no epistemological theory on which to fall back, admitting that it's not sufficiently worked out. Now, I also want to maintain, and this is what we'll start with, is that he doesn't even consider the strongest case against his presupposed atheism, namely the transcendental challenge. But there are certain illustrations or facets of that approach which are addressed in a different context, in a different way, and I would like to go through the book and hopefully before lunch discuss what he does with them as well.